Hi, I'm Patty Daniels. I'm the supervising producer of The World. Often when you think of The World, you might first think about the voices and the reporting you hear on air. It's essential journalism that connects you and helps you understand the world around you. But there is so much more that is going on behind the scenes to make this show work. That means producers, editors, engineers, our whole studio team, all working together to bring you the best journalism with the highest production values. Our team has to be nimble, responsive, and rely on deep experience to make sure the news program you hear each weekday afternoon is the best it can be. We do this work for you. And actually, we can't do this work without you. We have a fundraising goal now through December 31st to raise $67,000 to support our nonprofit newsroom. And we're counting on you to make this campaign a success. Trusted global journalism is already reason enough to give. But here's one more incentive. A generous donor will match your donation one for one. Consider making a gift of $250 to The World. And our newsroom will receive $500 thanks to you and the power of teamwork. Visit theworld.org/give to learn more and make your donation now. That's theworld.org/give. Thank you. Your gift makes all the difference. And now, here's the show.
The big question hanging over Israel's war on Gaza, who will govern the Palestinian territory once the fighting is over?
Palestinian Authority says they don't want to go back to Gaza riding on an Israeli tank.
The U.S. and Israel are seemingly at odds in their visions of the future. For now, Gaza is still a war zone with innocent people caught in the crossfire.
These civilians have nothing to do with Hamas. Gaza is not Hamas, and they are paying a heavy price.
I'm Marco Werman. Also today on the show, the actors' strike is over, and that means Hollywood money is unlocked.
China, India, Nigeria are the countries where the most number of movies are getting made. The movies with the biggest budgets are always the U.S. films.
And shifting migration patterns, why that's happening, we look at two cases and more today on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. Thank you for being here. The Gaza Strip continues to be racked by violence. Today, gun battles erupted between Hamas and Israel's military, not far from the Al-Quds Hospital in Gaza City. Thousands of Palestinian civilians are sheltering at the hospital now, seeking refuge from violence. Many others are heading farther south in the Gaza Strip. Also today, Israel announced a daily four-hour humanitarian pause that would allow civilians out of Gaza City. Meanwhile, the question of who should govern Gaza is emerging as a focus for leaders. U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken said yesterday that it should not be Israel.
Gaza cannot continue to be run by Hamas. That simply invites a repetition of October 7th, and Gaza uses a place from which to launch terrorist attacks. It's also clear that Israel cannot occupy Gaza.
Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, however, maintains his country will maintain overall security responsibility in Gaza indefinitely. For more, we turn to Nathan Brown. He's a visiting fellow at the Hamburg Institute for Advanced Study and a professor at George Washington University. He joins us today from Hamburg. Nathan, I know you've been thinking about this question of what comes next in Gaza after the Israeli military action is over. What is a possible and realistic outcome for who or what should be in charge?
Well, the more realistic outcome, especially after Netanyahu's statement about continuing security control, is that there won't be an afterwards. In other words, this is an Israeli military campaign that is about ousting Hamas from power, but not necessarily with any definitive endpoint after that. What Israel wants to do is to ensure Gaza can't be used as a base for attacks against Israel, and Israel is convinced, at least its current leadership is convinced, that only Israel can make that happen. So there won't be a sort of a clean end to this conflict as Israel, according to Israel's current position.
I mean, what does that entail if Israel is there indefinitely?
Well, Israel has controlled an awful lot of what goes in and out of Gaza and the sea and the air over it. But what this would mean might be something a little bit more intrusive internally, periodic Israeli raids, arrests, and that sort of thing. The second thing that it could possibly mean, and that's not quite clear, is relocation of some of the population of Gaza. from the north to the south. And a third thing that it would mean would be that if you have Israel, perhaps with some continued military presence, no other actor is going to want to go in there and say essentially, okay, we're subcontracting for continued Israeli military occupation.
So there is a big difference in U.S. and Israeli government perspectives on this. Can you tell me what each says they want and why there's such a difference between the two?
Well, Israel says that it doesn't want to reoccupy Gaza, but what it is enunciating now sounds to most people like a reoccupation. The United States is very, very clear that what Israel should do would be is to defeat Hamas, oust it from power, and then leave, and leave to some other governance body. But it's not clear what or who that would be. And the United States has all kinds of ideas, but none of the possible candidates are interested in taking on that role. The United States' preferred choice long-term would be the Palestinian Authority in Ramallah, which essentially used to govern parts of Gaza. They say they're not interested. There might be some kind of multinational force, maybe Arab states, maybe UN, that might go in some way to provide services and even to provide internal security.
Where would Israel stand on this idea of the Palestinian Authority taking over in Gaza? And do you think the PA has enough legitimacy among the Palestinian population that they could lead?
Current Israeli leadership does not want to deal with Palestinians as a single national movement. But even if they change their minds, Palestinian Authority says they don't want that. They don't want to go back to Gaza. They keep on using this phrase, you know, riding on an Israeli tank. So what they say they want is some clear declaration that there's going to be a Palestinian state at the end of this. There's going to be a major diplomatic initiative. And those are promises that so far nobody's been willing to make them. And that in the past, when it's been suggested, those suggestions haven't been taken as credible. And then there's a final problem. The Palestinian Authority is a spent force politically. It is one that essentially administers towns and cities in the West Bank and Gaza, but is run by older figures and has almost no credibility with the younger generation of Palestinians.
So, Nathan, with the U.S. saying one thing, a thing that is still kind of unclear, and Israel and Netanyahu saying another, how do you think this difference is going to play out as Israel clears out Hamas from Gaza?
I would like to be able to suggest that there will be a happy ending, but I think that's unlikely. I think what is most likely is that what will happen will be some kind of international structure that the United States will be able to say, okay, we're turning it over to some international body. There will be UN agencies providing food and doing some reconstruction work and some international NGOs there. And there will be some kind of vague governance structure, but it won't be one that will effectively govern Gaza. Israel will be a continued presence there and will certainly guarantee its own security, but it won't provide public security in Gaza, and it won't really allow for, I think, a full reemergence of a real governance structure that runs hospitals, schools, clinics, and transportation, and so forth and so on.
You don't sound terribly encouraged by the future and what Gaza could look like after this conflict.
No, I mean, I think it is possible that enough international actors will have a sort of wake up and smell the coffee moment and will say this is the time to finally resolve this dispute. I think that's possible. There are some precedents for some attempts, but the international community seems so badly divided and I think probably unwilling to take on the kind of diplomatic confrontations and security and fiscal commitments that would involve. So I think it's possible, but unlikely.
We should remember that Israel actually governed Gaza previously between 1967 until the early 90s when the Oslo Accords were signed. How did that go?
Well, Israel got sick of it. I mean, it did build some settlements for Israeli citizens in there, but there weren't that many of them. It did sort of oversee Gaza governance, again, sort of education and schools, hospitals, and so on. But it was during that period that Hamas arose as a movement and the Intifada, the Palestinian uprising against Israel, began. And so what Israel found out was that it wasn't guaranteeing its own security. It was costing money and sometimes costing blood and just a big headache. And so they finally just said unilaterally, we are going to withdraw and we don't care what comes next.
I mean, that's a great point. Is that an argument against Israel staying in Gaza to govern going forward, that maybe it'll produce something even worse than Hamas?
I think that is an Israeli worry, but the response is not to say, therefore, we won't go back into Gaza. It's to say, we won't govern Gaza. We will maintain whatever we need for our own security, but what Gazans do, you know, when it comes to economic development or schools or hospitals, that's their business, not ours.
Nathan Brown is a visiting fellow at the Hamburg Institute for Advanced Study and a professor at George Washington University. He joined us from Hamburg. Nathan, thank you very much for this.
Thank you.
The front line in the war between Russia and Ukraine has not moved much in the past year. Last week, Ukraine's commander-in-chief told The Economist that the conflict has reached a stalemate. Russia still occupies about 18% of Ukrainian territory. For Ukrainians living under Russian occupation, security and safety are obviously a major concern. Many have chosen to flee. The World's Daniel Hoffman reports from the border between Russia and Latvia.
For those Ukrainians caught under Russian occupation, there aren't many good options. Some decide to stay, living in uncertain and often unsafe conditions. Others seek safer conditions in Russia. Another option is fleeing via a third country. This is the Grebneva border checkpoint in eastern Latvia. Russia is just a stone's throw away. On the other side of the border, Ukrainians are lined up hoping to enter Latvia. Sometimes Russian border guards interrogate Ukrainians for hours. In some cases, they wait for a few days without shelter and without food. Once the Ukrainians cross the border from Russia into Latvia, they're greeted by a couple volunteers here at this Tochka Dopomogi, which is help point in Ukrainian. There's a sign outside of their tent with a Ukrainian flag. Volunteers provide hot water, shelter, a warm place to rest, and some clean clothing for those who need to change. This is Alina Kirilenko. She's with an NGO called Tavi Draugi, which is Latvian for your friends. She started volunteering here at the border back in March. Kirilenko says she understands what many of the Ukrainians who cross this border are going through, because she was one of them. She says that before coming to Latvia in April of last year, she was living under Russian occupation in eastern Ukraine.
We didn't have any other way out. Some tried driving towards Kharkiv, but the Russians would shoot at those cars.
Kirilenko says she and her children decided to go east into Russia. They placed signs on her car that said, "Kids on board." They crafted white flags out of bedsheets. Kirilenko says they were stopped at more than a dozen checkpoints. Eventually, they entered Russia, but they didn't stay for long. A few weeks later, they crossed yet another border into Latvia. Now she helps other Ukrainians do the same.
When they cross the border, they say the air is different here.
Kirilenko is one of many volunteers. They work in 48-hour shifts, welcoming the new arrivals on the other side of the checkpoint.
When I start speaking Ukrainian to them, they immediately understand this is a good place. Europe is a free place, a place that welcomes them.
And Kirilenko doesn't just help people around here. She also feeds some of the stray cats that wander around this border area.
I feel bad for them too. This cat looks scared. I'm going to leave it some food over there.
At first, the orange tabby cat keeps its distance, but a few moments later, it eats. About a 40-minute drive from the border is a town called Rezhegne. Some Ukrainians who cross the border come here as a transit point before continuing their journey back to Ukraine or elsewhere in Europe.
My name is Malyarov Denis. I'm 15 years old. I'm from Ukraine, Izum. It's a city. No small city.
Denis lives here in Rezhegne with his mom and sister. Before coming here, they also lived under Russian occupation. Izum, their hometown, was a war zone.
Он був пожарником, і в один день, коли там поїхав на зміну.
My father was a firefighter, Denis says. One day, during one of his shifts, he was hit by incoming fire. He was injured, and they weren't able to get him to the hospital in time. Denis says his father was killed in May of last year. It was hardest for my mom, Denis says. That's one of the reasons we decided to come to Latvia. Denis says his mom's best friend lives in Rezegne and that she's helped their family settle here. Denis says it's difficult for him to talk about his dad. He prefers not to. We have a new life here, he says. Everything is good. He's not sure, though, if he wants to go back to Ukraine, but he also says that these days it's hard to plan ahead. I learned this from all my travels, and of course from the war, he says. They told us it would end in 3 days, and every 3 days they would say that. Right now, Denis is just trying to hang out and have fun. Tonight, he says, he's going to the movies with some friends, like a normal teenager. For The World, I'm Daniel Hoffman in Riga, Latvia.
Palestinians outside of the Middle East are watching the events in Gaza with alarm. Just ahead, that experience for one Palestinian journalist in Amsterdam. You're listening to The World.
Want to dive into how technology and Black spirituality intersect? Or confront the challenges new tech is creating? Maybe even catch a vision of hope for the future?
Check out Moral Repair, a Black exploration of tech. A podcast about the innovations that make our world and break our societies.
And how we can all heal just a bit. Available on Spotify, Apple, and wherever you listen to podcasts.
I'm Marco Werman. You're listening to The World. Palestinians around the globe are watching the events in Gaza, often filled with anguish for family and friends who live there. Tagrid El-Hodri grew up in Gaza and lives now in Amsterdam. Her perspective is not just personal, though. El-Hodri reported for the New York Times from inside Gaza for almost a decade, including during the 2008-2009 Gaza war with Israel. When we spoke this week, she recounted for me what happened recently at the main bakery in Gaza City.
For the first time in the history of the Gaza Strip, people went into that bakery and stole flour. This is like, and it's not about poor people. It's people who are middle class jumping, you know, from wherever, you know, getting into that bakery and stealing the flour. And what Israel is doing now, they are shooting the solar system, which people use to charge their phone in order to be in contact with loved ones. And whoever is in Gaza City, they are so afraid to leave the place.
Right. And these are stories you are hearing in your conversations with friends in Gaza City.
It's my immediate families I'm talking to. These civilians have nothing to do with Hamas. Gaza is not Hamas. And they are paying a heavy price by both sides. And it's really madness. My family is scattered. Part of them, they are in Gaza City in our house. Part of my family, they managed to go in the middle areas, but there was bombing. And then what happened, they were obliged to go back to my house. And then my mother and my sister, she's now in the middle areas. And my nephews, my nieces, my other sister, they are also in the middle areas, central, outside Gaza City. And another sister with her family in the south. For the first time in our history, my family is displaced, and this we have never experienced in our lifetime. My mother, you know, because we are used to have this family group on Facebook Messenger, we have a family group, and we always every day, hi, how are you, good morning. And I used to be annoyed at my mother when she used to ask me, what are you cooking for the kids today? A question I always hated. And I told her yesterday, Mama, I missed that question, that I used to be so annoyed with it. So my mother managed to leave Gaza. We begged her. She didn't want to leave her house. She loves her house. She loves her garden. But we convinced her to leave. And at the beginning, Marco, at the beginning, people were like, oh my God, what have you, Hamas, done? You know, they were critical the first week, but then when the international community took the side of Israel and Israel has to respond and to revenge without consideration to international law, that shifted the anger to the international community, mainly the U.S. And now people are saying the U.S. and Israel, they are both waging the war on us as civilians. That's what you hear from people on the ground.
I want to ask you, Tagrid, about the coverage. I mean, there are few international journalists on the ground in Gaza today other than the handful embedded with Israel's army. There are local Palestinian journalists in Gaza supplying news to international outlets. But how does who is telling the story impact how it's received internationally?
Marco, sadly, nobody from the international mainstream media is in Gaza City. Only Al Jazeera Arabic correspondent and the cameraman and the photographers. They are still in Gaza City in the hospitals.
Let me go back to the 2008-2009 Israel-Gaza conflict, when you were one of the few correspondents reporting from inside Gaza. We know at the time it was Israel that stood in the way of letting Western reporters have access to Gaza. I want to ask you about that time. What sort of coverage were you able to provide?
I felt extremely responsible for getting facts because I was alone. I didn't have a team. And what I did, I went to the hospitals myself, the Shifa Hospital. Many elements came from people's mouth during that time when they lost loved ones, the curses they did to God, the curses they did to Hamas, the curses they did to the U.S., the curses they did against, you know, Israel. So the pain, even, you know, when a fighter came and he was injured, and I asked him at that time, how does it feel for you when you listen to all this pain around you? This is what we are missing, asking the questions while things are happening on the ground.
I know this was a different time, 2008, 2009. I mean, you were able to report and write about really sensitive topics, like how angry some civilians in Gaza were with the fighters who were firing rockets from densely populated civilian areas. I mean, you even interviewed an Islamic Jihad fighter at the Al-Shifa Hospital. How did you manage to do that, though?
By being objective, by being independent, because people, they know who you are. You know, you don't belong to anyone. You don't have an agenda.
But how did, like, Hamas at the time react to the fact that you were working for a U.S.-based outlet and you were touching these very sensitive topics?
Even I was a witness to a spy being killed in front of my eyes. I was asked by Hamas not to cover it, but I said, don't talk to me this way, and I covered it. So in a way, you can impose it. You don't want to be aggressive. You want to be respectful. You want to be like a listener, but you are just an observer. And you just describe it as it is. And at the Shifa Hospital, where I was walking on bodies, like in between bodies, I remember very well, I was just observing. But for me, I'm always touched by the civilians. And the civilians are the one being hurt. And at that time, same. But here, the magnitude is immense. War crimes, they are taking place by both sides. But what do we need? We need journalists to be on the ground to investigate. This is missing. It's really madness.
Tagrid El-Khodri grew up in Gaza and reported from Gaza for the New York Times from 2001 to 2009. She joined us from Amsterdam. Thank you very much, Tagrid. Good to speak with you.
Thank you, Marco. Thank you.
Our coverage of the war between Israel and Hamas is capturing many voices and perspectives. Listen to our reporting and interviews at theworld.org, where you can also explore a timeline of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict that helps to put the current war in context. That's at theworld.org. Jamaican dance music in the 60s was hardwired to sounds that drifted over the Caribbean from American radio stations.
She's been gone on her own, and now I'm left alone.
Singer Barris Hammond is one of the great voices to emerge from that mashup. He's known as the King of Lovers Rock, and as of this week, another title, Doctor of Letters.
I confer upon you the degree of Doctor of Letters, honoris causa of this university. Congratulations, Dr. Hammond.
Dr. Hugh Beresford Hammond reminded the students and faculty at the University of the West Indies in Kingston of his Jamaican musical guides and his American ones.
I was inspired by Alton Ellis, Stevie Wonder, Sam Cooke, Otis Redding, and folks like that.
After he spoke, Hammond led the audience through one of his big hits, Rockaway.
Remember the songs used to make you... When love sang, we dance all night to the songs they played.
music of Dr. Barris Hammond of Jamaica there. You're listening to The World.
I'm Darren.
And I'm Esther.
And this is Second Sunday, a podcast about Black queer folk finding, keeping, and sometimes losing faith.
This season's full of candid conversations. We're talking to theologians, artists, activists, and community members living at the intersections of faith, spirituality, and identity.
The saints ain't ready for this.
But we're still going to talk about it.
Second Sunday. Find it wherever you get podcasts.
Second Sunday is a Cube original podcast and is part of the PRX Big Questions Project.
Australians are wading into marshes, lakes, and streams this week to capture the sounds of their country's frogs.
There is no way I can do this frog justice, but they sound like...
Tag along with our reporter as she joins in.
Listen to that.
I think there's hundreds of those frogs.
Still ahead, here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. It's The World. We're a co-production of GBH, Boston, and PRX. So far this year, Spain has seen the arrival of some 32,000 migrants. That is a new record, and the year is not over yet. Most of those people are now arriving on the Spanish Canary Islands in the Atlantic. A majority of them, like these recent seagoers, are from Senegal in West Africa. They make the dangerous trip in small, open boats. The route is not new, but what has changed is the particular island the boat captains are aiming for. The World's Jerry Haddon reports from El Hierro.
At El Hierro's small southern port, they're running out of room for the confiscated smugglers' boats, known as cayucos. On a recent morning, I count 29 of the brightly painted wooden vessels tied off to the docks. Then another motors in. The 70 people crammed on board panic and nearly tip their boat over at the sight of safety. They've been at sea for 8 days. Red Cross workers help the mostly young Senegalese men onto the pier. They can barely walk. One man, unconscious, leaves in an ambulance. El Hierro, population 10,000, has taken in nearly that number of migrants this fall alone. Until recently, few cayucos came this way. El Hierro is tiny and far out at sea, the westernmost Canary Island. If you miscalculate and miss it with your boat, that's it. There's just open ocean and almost certain death. But for the last few months, desperate Senegalese and their smugglers have stopped hugging the coastline and started heading out as far to sea as they can, because doing so lessens a different danger, getting caught by Senegal's Coast Guard and being sent home. Senegal has been engulfed in political unrest, sparked by the jailing of political opposition leader Ousmane Sonko 2 years ago. The instability has made life there more dangerous, finding jobs even harder. Young men are fleeing in record numbers. On El Hierro, some villagers worry that the massive exodus from Africa could create chaos here. We're going to end up like Lampedusa, says one man near the port who won't give his name. He's referring to the Italian island that's been overwhelmed by migrants leaving mostly from Tunisia on the Mediterranean.
Porque precisamente eso ha sido una de las claves que no haya habido una contestación social.
But the government official in charge of this Spanish island, Alpidio Armas, doesn't like the comparison. Armas says Lampedusa migrants have gotten stuck by the thousands as Europe argues over who should take them. We don't have that pressure, he says, because migrants here are sent within days to other islands, then onto refugee centers on the Spanish mainland. But first, they're bused to an old monastery turned shelter here for showers, rest, and a few hot meals. The monastery is off limits to reporters, but a Spanish volunteer inside leaves me this message.
Tuve que cargarlos a varios.
I had to carry a few of the new arrivals to the medical station here, says Gilberto Carballo. They're exhausted and hungry, he says, and some are looking critically ill. The doctors were worried for them, he says, so they've been taken to the hospital. At a nearby cafe, Carballo and his wife, Teseida Padron, also a volunteer, show me photos of young men with cuts or burns on their arms, backs, and legs. It's from their skin rubbing against the boat for so many days, Padron says. We had to use jars and jars of lubricant, Carballo says, to peel the shirt off of one screaming boy's scab-covered back. The material had dried into the blood. Same with his pants and underwear.
It was very hard. I think so is the difficult thing I never faced before in my life.
This is Kajali Baro, an 18-year-old who made the crossing from Senegal a year ago. He says he feels for the new arrivals. On his trip, after 3 days at sea, he and his 78 fellow migrants ran out of food and water. I was sure it was the end, he says.
I'm dead because I don't have water. We are drinking the seawater almost 2 days.
Baro now lives here on El Hierro. He works as a counselor at an overcrowded shelter for underage refugees. Under Spanish law, kids can't be deported, so most stay in state custody until they're 18, then get residency, like Baro did. His advice to young newcomers?
It's all about life. Life, you focus and concentrate. When someone can tell you today, hey, here we have here diamond, gold, and silvers, that's not true. I told him that here life is very difficult. You have to struggle before you make it.
Struggle to get residency papers, to learn Spanish, to find work, and to defend yourself against rising anti-immigrant sentiment across Europe.
En El Hierro estamos viendo una auténtica invasión migratoria.
The leader of Spain's far-right Vox party, Santiago Cabascal, came to El Hierro in October, just after thousands of migrants had arrived. We're seeing a real invasion here, he said. These migrants are male and of military age. The crisis is only going to get worse. Vox's message doesn't seem to resonate with many people on this tiny island. By and large, what you find here is empathy for the Africans. The underage Senegalese packed into that shelter for kids, a bunch of them have been recruited to play on a local high school soccer team. One afternoon before practice, the Spanish and Senegalese players joke together on the sidelines. They've just joined the team, one Spanish boy says, but they play a lot better than we do, says another.
El malo, el malo.
Except for that guy, they joke, ribbing a Senegalese player. He's bad. They all grin. It's a moment of teenage merriment in an otherwise tragic context. In 2022 alone, nearly 1,700 people disappeared en route from Africa to the Canaries, says Spanish NGO Caminando Fronteras. In the last week, 5 migrants arrived on El Hierro already dead.
Inmenso.
One young man on the boat I saw pull in, the one who went to the hospital, he died too. This is his funeral. Held by volunteers and some politicians. The engraving marking his final resting place says simply, immigrant. No date of birth. Just the day he died. For The World, I'm Jerry Haddon, El Hierro, the Canary Islands, Spain.
Another common destination for many migrants crossing from the African continent is Italy. This week, Italian Prime Minister Giorgia Meloni announced a plan to divert migrants away from her country and into nearby Albania. Italy will build 2 processing centers in Albania to house people intercepted at sea by Italian authorities. Susanna Zanfrini is Italy country director for the International Rescue Committee. She explained to The World why her group opposes the plan.
We are deeply concerned about this deal. From a humanitarian perspective, definitely the standalone definition of processing migrants is deeply dehumanizing and is basically impacting the dignity of refugees and asylum seekers. People have the fundamental right to arrive to Europe and claim asylum and should be treated with dignity and respect. This deal basically allows the Italian authorities to intercept people at sea and bringing them to offshore de facto detention facilities outside of the European Union territory.
Yeah, so as you said, migrants intercepted at sea are the ones who will be taken to Albania. Is it all of them or just some of them?
There are still many things to be understood about the details and the practicalities. It seems like migrants that are being intercepted by the Italian Coast Guards and that are not in one of the vulnerable categories, namely children, pregnant women, and other vulnerables, all the others will be taken to Albania. Also, the centers have a capacity of 3,000 people only, so it seems unlikely that if the numbers keep being the same of arrivals with over 140,000 arrived by sea just in 2023, it seems unlikely that all of them are going to be taken to Albania.
And yet, the Italian Prime Minister Meloni says the centers will start by hosting 3,000 people, but eventually the hope is to scale up their capacity to 36,000 people a year.
So it's unclear if it's like all at the same time or 36,000 in a year, meaning there will be a high turnover.
And do you understand whether these folks will be kept in Albania through this whole asylum application process, or will they be able to go to Italy to make their case?
It seems like they will be kept for first a screening. It's unclear whether this screening will entail the whole asylum process. It will be just a fast-tracked asylum process, which is possible at the moment, according to local legislation, just for people coming from the so-called safed third countries that are listed by Italy and some also by the EU legislation. It seems also challenging and definitely really concerning if this is the case, because it would mean that asylum seekers are kept into de facto detention facilities for the whole duration of their asylum procedure, which in Italy at the moment takes a very long time, many months.
Yeah, so this action of keeping migrants offshore for asylum processing, it's not the first time this policy has been used. The UK has tried to send people to Rwanda, as you know, though that policy is currently kind of frozen by lawsuits. Is this third country approach part of a trend? And ultimately, what do you think is driving it?
I have to say, I think it is a part of a trend, and worryingly an increasing trend. It's not an effective deterrent. People will try to migrate anyway. They will try to reach European shores regardless of these provisions. And it will just be more dangerous for them, more costly. We'll just witness more deaths and more trauma. I think it's part of the overall idea of this safety, securitarian approach, so-called Fortress Europe, instead of creating legal and safe channels.
Susanna Zanfrini is Italy Country Director for the International Rescue Committee. She spoke to us from Milan. Susanna, thank you very much indeed.
Thank you, Marco.
The actors' strike ended at midnight as the SAG-AFTRA union reached a tentative deal to go back to making movies and TV. Production sets in the U.S. went silent during the strike, and the overlapping one for writers. Now, Hollywood's movie and TV making is valued at some $134 billion, and when it virtually shut down, the costs rippled across the globe. Productions overseas continued however they could. Miranda Banks is a film professor at Loyola Marymount University in Los Angeles. I asked her how she felt when she heard the strike is over.
Enormous relief. And, you know, I'm happy for all sides. Everybody wants to get back to work, and being able to finish this up before the end of the year and for some production to get back on track is vital for the industry that's been suffering for 6 months.
So we've heard about some places overseas that picked up more TV and film shooting that couldn't be done in the U.S. while the strike was happening, while some other foreign locations basically shut down. What does the end of the actor strike mean for them?
Well, it really means everything is open for business now, especially with so many international co-productions, as well as the kind of complicated issues of actors who are members of SAG-AFTRA, who will only work under those conditions within a global production. They don't have to worry about any of these things anymore, or at least hopefully for the next 3 years. But to be quite honest, I think the actors made such a significant deal that I think this one will hold for a good long time. But in terms of the future for global production, it really means that everyone can get back to work. That said, there will be negotiations again next year that relate to a lot of the crew positions. And so we may want to keep our eyes on those into the future as well.
So overseas production hotspots, whether it's Vancouver or Prague or Morocco, I mean, did this whole strike provide something of a learning moment for those places?
I think so. I mean, I do think that everyone is aware of these labor conditions and concerns. And for a very long time, Hollywood has kind of set the precedent for what expectations are. Obviously, part of overseas production was, in fact, to get away from Hollywood union deals and the heavy financial burden on the studios for using union crews.
Yeah, I mean, Hollywood is so kind of baked into other productions overseas, whether it's production itself or financing. Do you think film industries in other countries are going to try to be a little more independent now from what's going on in Hollywood?
I'm not quite sure that they will be. I think that Hollywood comes to the table with so much money.
Right.
While Hollywood doesn't make the most number of films in the world, those are usually China, India, Nigeria are the countries where the most number of movies are getting made. The movies with the biggest budgets are always the U.S. films.
So streaming, as opposed to going to a movie theater and buying a ticket, streaming was a big point of contention during the strikes. What was the disagreement and how does it look like it might get worked out?
So with streaming, it really had to do mostly with the idea of television. So for example, when people go to the movies, we know exactly how much that movie is making because we have box office numbers. And that's always kind of set terms of, you know, how much compensation people might get.
Right.
With streaming, all of that information is locked down and the studios don't want to share it. What does success mean for a writer, for a director, for an actor if they have no box office numbers, if they have no rating success, and they can hear a show might be doing well, but a streamer isn't necessarily going to pay them anymore because they're generally paying up front?
Miranda, put on your moviegoer hat just a second. What have you missed most about filmmaking during the strike?
Oh, it's that feeling of you're excited for something to come out and you're looking forward to, you know, whatever's going to be in the theaters. I'm watching a lot of sports these days. So I love my sports. Don't get me wrong. I'm a huge fan, but I can't wait for big movies. I can't wait for my TV shows to come back and to really sit down as the weather changes and enjoy some good TV.
Miranda Banks is an associate professor of film, television, and media studies at Loyola Marymount University in Los Angeles. Miranda, thanks very much.
Oh, always a pleasure.
A bit of good news now for the family of star Colombian soccer player Luis Diaz. His father has been freed 12 days after being kidnapped in northern Colombia. The guerrilla group ELN, the National Liberation Army, was behind the kidnapping of both of Diaz's parents. His mother was released earlier. As we reported yesterday, the situation alarmed Colombians who remember ELN's history of violent abductions. The guerrilla group and the Colombian government reached a ceasefire agreement in August. I'm Marco Werman. It's The World. Frogs sometimes get a bad rap. Maybe you remember hearing as a kid that they give you warts, or you just see them as slimy and gross. Look no further for evidence of this frog maligning than Disney's The Princess and the Frog.
There is no way in this whole wild world I would ever, 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 I mean never, kiss a frog. Yuck!
Poor little amphibians can't get no respect. But frogs are vital to our planet. They're also in decline. In Australia, frogs are under threat from climate change, pollution, and disease. That's why biologists at the Australian Museum in Sydney are asking the general public for help. The World's Sarah Birnbaum reports from Sydney on the 6th annual Frog ID Week, which runs through Sunday.
Frog ID Week is Australia's biggest frog count. Anyone with a smartphone can go out, record frog calls, and then send them through an app to the experts at the Australian Museum for identification. Henry Lewis is one of the top froggers in the country. I asked him how many recordings he's submitted over the years.
16,027.
16,027.
Henry is seven. He and his dad, Chris, started looking for frogs during lockdown, and they've managed to locate 29 different species. I asked Henry for some tips.
Look, this is our very first year going out looking for frogs with a frog ID. Where should we go?
Any swamp or river or stuff like that.
And what time of day should I go?
About 3:30 or to 7 o'clock.
That's right around bedtime. Does that ever happen to you that you need to go to bed but you need to find frogs?
Sometimes.
The struggle is real. Frog ID Week is part of a rise globally in citizen science projects where volunteers collect data about the natural world for use by researchers. So far, the Frog ID Project has collected nearly 1 million frog calls. The recordings, along with GPS coordinates and timestamps, go into a public database. Frog ID is the brainchild of Dr. Jody Rowley.
I'm the curator of amphibian and reptile conservation biology at the Australian Museum.
Are you a herpetologist or frog spurt? You know,
I do say frog scientist or frog biologist a lot, yeah.
She says Frog ID has changed the game in terms of frog conservation in Australia.
Recordings that people have just made, you know, by their back door, down the road while walking the dog have actually been used to help discover new species.
Five new species to be exact, including the Spalding's rocket frog. Its calls have been described as turbocharged chicken clucks. And Dr. Rowley's favorite? The screaming tree frog.
There is no way I can do this frog justice, but they sound like... Well, actually, we've had people write in and say, what is this noise? Like, I think this is, I need to burn my shed down because there's something strange calling in it.
Even though they don't always sound pretty, frogs are vital to our ecosystems. They eat billions of insects, tadpoles graze on algae, and lots of wildlife feed on them. They also make really good bioindicators, and that's because of their thin, permeable skin. When pollution or other environmental changes affect a habitat, frogs are usually the first to go. They provide an early warning that something is wrong with the ecosystem. That's why tracking frog populations is so important, says Rowley. And unfortunately, the numbers are depressing.
One in five Australian frogs are threatened with extinction. And certainly it is a bit of a scary thing when we've got droughts, fires, all those kind of things. But overwhelmingly, Frog ID has given us hope.
Hope because of the tens of thousands of people standing there with their phones, engaged and passionate about frog conservation, including my crew. I think we have to be really quiet. Okay, let's keep... That's it! Okay, that's a frog. We took young Henry Lewis's advice and went to a marsh after bedtime, despite my better judgment. Listen to that!
I think there's hundreds of those frogs.
I hear...
I'd never noticed all the frogs before until I started listening for them. It opened up a whole new soundscape. All right, I think we should. I think it's bedtime.
Ribbit, ribbit.
Bye, froggies.
See you later.
That was amazing.
It really was. I thought it really was. Don't you think so?
Yeah.
That's three more for Team Frog. For the world, I'm Sarah Birnbaum in Sydney.
We land the show today in southwestern Iceland on the Reykjanes Peninsula. It's a popular destination for birding and taking in nature, but right now the focus there is on what's happening underground. This is just one of some 1,400 tremors to strike the area last night. It was recorded by a resident in nearby Grindavik. Such tremors are caused by the flow of magma deep underground, the same magma that creates geothermal energy for southern Iceland and heats the waters of one of the country's hottest tourist draws, the Blue Lagoon. The magma also lies under a nearby collection of craters.
And we call this place Illarönskýr.
A YouTuber who goes by the handle Just Iceland says this name gives locals the willies.
Since the name Illarönskýr means evil lava craters.
Yep, the molten lava underneath the evil lava craters began to move about a month ago, causing tens of thousands of tremors and some moderate earthquakes. No major damage as of yet. Local TV covered a meeting last night where civil defense officials and geologists determined next steps. An actual volcanic eruption could happen. It might mean the evacuation of the nearby town of Grindavik, and it could threaten the geothermal power plant, which could then plunge the peninsula into darkness. Right now, the main impact has been the closure of the local spa, the Blue Lagoon. Tourists who traveled down from the capital Reykjavik this morning did not know about the earthquakes or that the Blue Lagoon was closed as a precaution.
Oh my gosh! Oh no! That stinks! We'll have to book a trip back, I guess.
So far, the spa is closed just for a week. The World comes to you each weekday from the Nan and Bill Harris Studio at GBH in Boston and the Department of Communication at UC San Diego. You can find us online anytime at theworld.org. I'm Marco Werman. Be safe. Stay strong. We'll see you right back here tomorrow. Marco here. Before we go, just a reminder that right now the World is holding our fall fundraising drive. Your support is critical. It powers our nonprofit newsroom so we can continue to bring you the best in international reporting. Our goal is to raise $67,000 before the end of the year. Every gift counts. Please visit theworld.org/give to learn more and donate. That's theworld.org/give. Thank you so much and be well.
From PRX.